Welcome to the Attraction Pros Podcast, where professionals in the attractions business can get insight, tips, tools, and even a bit of inspiration. Your hosts are two people familiar with the twists and turns and ups and downs of this great industry. Josh Lieben is the Director of Business Development for Amusement Advantage, and Matt Heller is the founder of Performance Optimist Consulting.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Attraction Pros Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today. I am Joshua Liebman, and I've got Matt Heller with me today. Matt, how's the weather in North Carolina?
It is fantastic. 100% chance of sun, rain, clouds, or thunderstorms today.
100% chance of some sort of weather. That's good. Today, we've got Chris Gray from Skyline Attractions. Chris, how are you doing?
Good, guys. How are you?
Doing great.
Great.
How's the weather in Orlando?
Oh, it's, you know, in wonderfully sunny in the mornings and a little rainy in the afternoons, but that's our normal summer.
Right, absolutely. So, Chris, would love to hear a little bit about you. I'd love to hear about your history in the industry, and I'd love it if you can tell us a little bit about the birth of Skyline Attractions, and if we can go from there.
Yeah, so that's a pretty big question with a lot of broad points, but I'll try to do my best. So, you know, I've wanted to design and build roller coasters like everybody else here at Skyline since I was a young kid. I always say use eight, but I don't know if it was necessarily eight. I was fascinated with anything that ran on rails, and by the time that I was old enough to go to Kings Island and see the bat run through its track, I was completely fascinated. So at that point, you know, it was trying to figure out, well, what does it take to actually do this sort of thing? And then there was one year I was in seventh grade and on a youth group trip to Kings Island, and our bus driver for the youth group trip, which was also our vice principal of our middle school because we lived in a tiny little town in central Kentucky, was talking to me about, you know, what it takes to build big machines. And he goes, you know, somebody has got to do it, so why not you? And that really kind of threw me, you know, down the road that I basically started traveling on. So left school in Kentucky, graduated from Bourbon County, Kentucky, funny enough, and ultimately ended up in the military to try to get some money for college, and did a five-year stint in the U.S. Navy as a CB. So funny enough, the whole time I was in the military, I actually never stepped foot or seen a ship. So I lived in Iceland and Spain and all over the United States. But ultimately, I was trained to be a steel worker, which means I could fab big steel structures and pour concrete and weld and do anything that basically manipulated a piece of steel. And once I finished the military, I got out and moved back to Kentucky for 2.5 to 3 years, and I went to a small tech school called Spencerian College and got an associate's degree, and basically it ended up being like an architectural degree. And learned how to use AutoCAD, ended up teaching there, taught there for a while, and then the Great Coasters had called and said, hey, we have a possible job coming up. Are you still interested? And, of course, I'd been networking, going to the trade show since I was in the military, so the trade show being IAPA, and said yes. Basically took the job and drove most of my stuff to Pennsylvania and offloaded it in a storage facility, which was Jeff Pike's house, my business partner here at Skyline, because, of course, he was working there as well. And then 9/11 happened. And then after that, the whole job went kaputs for a complete year. So I basically had half my stuff in Pennsylvania for a whole year before the job was offered back, because ultimately they were looking to build a ride out in the Seattle area at the time. And after 9/11, everybody pulled all those jobs away from everybody. And so they didn't actually have a place for me to go. So at that point, I waited a year. I got another job in Kentucky. So I was working two jobs in Kentucky and teaching people how to use AutoCAD. And ultimately, when they called back, it was to build the Ozark Wildcat, and I moved to Pennsylvania and lived there for 13 years. And it's funny because the original plan was never to stay at Great Coasters for more than 5 years or five rides, and it ended up being 13 years and, I think, 17 rides.
Wow.
So,
wow.
It was quite a long time. I mean, you know, for me, the career path was to go work at Great Coasters for a few years and then maybe go work for a park for a few years and then maybe back over to the manufacturing side and just kind of bounce around. Ultimately, that's what I had seen a lot of people doing, and I thought, well, that's a pretty typical career path. But, you know, such is life. Things change and move around, and you do different things. And ultimately, that led to the birth of Skyline. So, funny enough, Jeff Pike was the guy that was working at Great Coasters before me that ultimately ended up saying, hey, why don't you come and work for us? And so I went. And then I think it was 6 years later, we had hired Evan Soulier to come and work for me as an intern at Great Coasters. And then 4 years ago, we decided that we wanted to break off and do our own thing. Basically, if it, you know, you look at it, it come down to the point of we loved wooden roller coasters. We just kind of felt like we've done a lot of them, and there was other things that we had always wanted to build and design and see if we could, you know, sell. And the only way that we're going to do that is if we probably break out on our own and see if we can pull it off. And ultimately, that led to the development of Skyline Attractions. And decided Florida was probably going to be one of the better places for us to start this up, just because it seems to be the mecca where everybody, you know, comes to visit that actually works in the amusement industry. And we thought we'd have a good place to be able to build stuff year-round. And ultimately, Orlando was where we landed. And so in the past 3 years, we've designed and developed attractions of all sizes, from games to kids' rides, all the way up to what we have now called Skywarp. And Skywarp is our first jaunt back into big roller coasters, and it's actually our first big steel coaster. And I don't know if you guys had seen the announcements, but we actually announced that we sold one. Of course, we can't say to who yet, but that announcement is, by the time this airs, it might actually be known. But yeah, so, you know, moving right along since then, we've taken over all of the engineering from Great Coasters International. So what we had done when we had left Great Coasters, we had still designed all the center lines for all the track since we had left. And basically Great Coasters would take that center line that Jeff had developed and then put all the structure under it, and they would engineer it themselves and then also support the job site. So in the past 6 months, we've taken over all of that here in our shop, and we actually brought in three of Great Coasters engineers on top of three engineers that we had already hired for Skywarp that brought us up to 10. So from now on, all of the Great Coasters rides that you see being built are designed and developed here in our office in Orlando. And then we support the construction side, which is all Great Coasters, on the build side of it. So anytime that the guys on the field have questions or, you know, need something figured out because it's a field issue, then they would call us if they couldn't get it answered by a few of the engineers that were left there on staff. So that's kind of where we are now. So we're in the middle of designing things for other people, but also designing our Skywarps and some future attractions as well. So
it sounds like – oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, it sounds like the separation from Great Coasters was pretty seamless, and that you guys seem to have a great relationship with them now. Was it always like that from the beginning?
Yeah, you know, it's always tough when you leave a place, you know, and everybody just trying to kind of find their way and fill those, you know, footholds and trying to, you know, keep everything moving as seamlessly and continuously as possible. And, you know, there's always, I don't like to say rough spots, but it definitely gets a little bumpy. But at the end of the day, we're all doing the same things. So, you know, it worked out really well, and Great Coasters is one of our best clients. So I think the way it works now is one of the best things that could have happened.
Hey, Chris, just for anybody who might be listening that doesn't know what centerline means, can you explain that?
Yeah, so if you can imagine, the center line of the coaster is where it's going in three-dimensional space. So basically the ups and downs and the control of the lift hill and the control of the controlled areas, like where you hit brakes and go through maintenance buildings and stations. So the actual center of the track of where it is in three-dimensional space at all times, that's a center line.
And I would imagine that has led to designing things differently by looking at that rather than, you know, in, like you mentioned, in AutoCAD, rather than kind of the old school method where they're kind of putting things up and hoping that it is smooth, and it might not be. So
yeah, and you know, it's all developing so quickly all around. We have a new guy on board that's actually been interning for us for 2 summers now, and he's got one more year of school left. His name is Dustin Sloan. But he's got some interesting things going on with how to develop center lines and actually do it all in real time in 3D, and it's pretty amazing stuff. And I think, quite honestly, everybody's kind of going to that. I mean, if you look at some of the stuff that Vekoma's building now, it's all pretty amazing how they've twisted it up around the center line of the ride, and everything looks super smooth. And Rocky Mountain, of course, is the other one. Al Schilke's been doing that for years, of course. I mean, you can go back and look at the Tennessee Tornado, and there was some really wild geometry being put in place on that ride that, you know, ultimately to this day has led it to be, 15 years old or more, that it's still a great, smooth ride.
It is, yeah, absolutely. And actually that leads to one of my questions. One of my favorite coasters that I just rode was Renegade up at Valley Fair, and I'm not just saying that because you're on the call today. But I would love to hear what some of your favorite rides are just to ride as an enthusiast.
Oh, you know, I think I'm always partial to Thunderhead. I hadn't ridden it in a long time, but there's a lot of history there with that ride and just kind of me in general. But ultimately, when we were building and commissioning that ride, if I'd gone home to Kentucky, I would always go down and see Thunderhead under construction because it was a few hours south of where my parents lived. You know, and for years, my parents, you know, they're just the average folks that never went to college and ended up getting a job in some factory in Kentucky and worked there their entire lives, and anything outside of that was a pipe dream. So when we built Thunderhead, it was really the first time that they were able to see that this job that I had wanted to do since I was a kid, which they thought was crazy, was real. And so, you know, Thunderhead was kind of that pinnacle for me, and so I've always got great ties back to it because of the memories that kind of, you know, made my family feel like what I was doing was not some kid playing on a big toy. You know, it's an actual job, it's real, and it's, you know, there's something to it. So Thunderhead is always good. You know, when it comes to steel rides, I've rode a lot of coasters all around the world, and there's pretty, you know, if you start talking about crazy things, I was always fascinated with Expedition G-Force, and I finally got to ride that several years ago. That was amazing. The Lisbergbana, that was another one I'd wanted to ride since I was a little kid. I'd seen pictures of that and was fascinated with it, you know, cruising all over that hillside. And a lot of times I don't know that it's necessarily about, you know, how wicked the ride is or how crazy the ride is, but it's about the memories that you have tied to those rides.
Right, sure.
And I think sometimes that's what leads them to be, you know, some of the favorite rides that you've ever been on. So, and, you know, right now I think the biggest thing that I would like to go ride if I could would be Fury. That just, I haven't heard one bad thing about it. It looks amazing. At some point in the next year and a half or so, I'd really like to get up there and check that one out.
Isn't that your favorite? That is, for a steel coaster, I mean, I can't do a lot of the coasters now that are rough and they've got the shoulder harnesses that bash your head back and forth, but Fury just has the lap bar and it's fast and it's smooth and there's airtime and it's just amazing. When I was there, and it's only 2 hours from my house now, which is awesome. When I was there 2 years ago, I think, with some buddies, it had closed during the day, and then it reopened, so we got right in line, and then we rode it like 8 times in a row for the last thing of the night, and it was just unforgettable. And, you know, like you say, Chris, the memories that you make there. So amazing ride, but also amazing memories from being able to ride it like 8 times in a row.
Yeah. You know, and if you go back and you look at my history of, you know, wanting to be in this industry. For instance, the day I was telling you about being at Kings Island with the youth group, when we got to the park that morning, this is things that I'll never forget, but the whole park was engulfed in fog. You couldn't see hardly anything when you first walked into the park. I mean, the fog was thick enough and low enough that you could actually see the top of the Eiffel Tower. And if I remember correctly, you see a little bit of vortex up through the cloud from the parking lot. And so the first thing we did, we ran into the park that morning, and we went straight to the Beast. And I'll never forget it because the only two things you could see of the beast was when you got to the top of the lift hill was the two lift hills. Everything else was covered in fog. And so we rode the whole ride that morning covered in fog, and it was beyond crazy. But later on that night we came back, and I think this was even more spectacular. But, you know, as a kid, the beast was the end-all be-all. And we ride it at night, and as you went over the first hill, it's completely dark, and you made the first turn to do the second drop out in the woods, and there had to be a million lightning bugs.
Oh, wow.
And literally it was like flying through a star cloud, you know. I mean, it was going through space. And for the rest of the ride until the second lift, it literally was like you were in pitch black darkness with lightning bugs everywhere. I mean, they were hitting you. They were all over your clothes. It was pretty crazy. But that was absolutely spectacular that night. And I'll never forget that.
Absolutely.
You know, I always have great fond memories of the beast. It's probably not my favorite ride in the world, but it's definitely spawned my career, I guess you would say, as one of the mm-hmm. big parts of trying to say, hey, I want to do that for a living. And those memories of that one day, I think were, you know, the beginning of this. So
that's awesome.
Chris, you mentioned a few minutes ago, you mentioned Rocky Mountain briefly, and I'm curious if I can kind of hear your thoughts on that and just kind of what they've been doing just with the wooden coaster over the last, you know, 6-7 years or so, and as far as just kind of taking it just in the direction that they've been going. Just want to hear kind of how you feel about that and the retrofitting current rides and just what your opinion is on that.
You know, funny enough, I've never ridden one yet.
And
literally, as we're speaking this morning, they're supposed to be announcing at Cedar Point what's coming.
That's right.
They look amazing. I was really interested in trying to get up and ride the one in New England, and then also the Colossus in California. I've drove past it now twice, and I've not been able to actually go ride it. But they both look to me as just an amazing ride. As for, you know, what they're doing with the wood structures, I think it's probably the only way that some of these rides will ever be preserved, although, you know, it's not the same ride, but at the same time, it might be better than tearing it completely down. You know, and I think it's just an evolution of the industry. You're gonna find things changing and you know, being torn down and then things replacing it. And, you know, the best thing you can do is always hope that the thing that's replacing it is better. You know, right now here at our office, about once a week we all go over and ride Dueling Dragons. Just because, you know, in a couple of weeks it's going to go away. And we've
yeah.
been riding that ride since 1999, thinking that was one of the greatest, you know, inverted ride combinations in the world. And I really think it probably still is. I just rode it the other night. I rode the Red Side for the first time in probably a couple of years. And I remember looking over at one of the guys going, this is definitely my favorite one because it has some really wicked stuff going on all the way through that you've never really felt on a B&M since.
True.
So, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you kind of got to look at it, and I know there's a lot of people that hem-haul and get really frustrated and mad, but at the same time, it's evolution. You know, it's going to happen. Things are going to change. You just have to be willing to accept it. So I think what they're doing is great. It's spawning a lot of interest, and people love the rides themselves. They look incredible. I can't wait to finally get to ride one, hopefully soon. And, you know, more power to them. So they're actually – Rocky Mountain's building the track for our Skywarp ride. So we've been up there and toured their facility and talked to Fred and Jake and some of the guys quite a bit. And, you know, they're a good group of guys, and their facility is amazing, by the way. If anybody ever got a chance to go up there and see
sure.
that, it's fascinating. But, yeah, you know, it is what it is. Hopefully we'll see more of it.
Sorry, go ahead, Matt.
I was going to say that their new Wonder Woman coaster for Fiesta Texas looks really, really cool.
Yeah, you know, I remember when that first kind of snuck out, and I looked at it, the very first time I looked at it, I was like, that piece of track that they built in their job site or on their property, that's the same piece of track that's going through the Wonder Woman. And I was telling one of my guys that, and he goes, oh, wow, that's cool. I didn't even notice that. And I'm like, Yeah, that was the first thing that I seen. I was like, why in the world is there a large flat S-turn up in the middle of that thing? And then it made a lot of sense. So, yeah, no, it looks really cool. So I'm actually really excited about seeing how those turn out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, what it does is it keeps the other wood manufacturers kind of on a good competitive edge, like with GCI and Gravity Group, as far as to, you know, that they acknowledge what Rocky Mountain is doing and to be able to kind of keep the classic wooden coaster alive. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, no, I think so, too. I think from what I understand, and I could be completely wrong, but there's a big difference in you know, pricing some of these things out, too. So, you know, if somebody's looking for a little $4.5 million, $5 million wooden roller coaster, I don't know if, you know, the Rocky Mountain thing would actually be what they're looking for. But you never know. Maybe it is. So, you know, I think there's little niches here and there and everywhere, but then there's also, you know, somebody wants a big, true wooden roller coaster. I wouldn't be shocked if Rocky Mountain would ever bid on that, too. I think they probably would. So I don't think it's quite, you know, their niche at the moment, but you never know. It's certainly how they got started.
Yeah, Chris, I would completely agree that, you know, that treatment has probably saved a couple of coasters. I know that, you know, Mean Streak at Cedar Point had just become unrideable to me. It was way too rough and not rough in a good way. So, you know, I definitely agree that that's, you know, that's saving some things from the wrecking pile for sure.
Yeah.
So I would love to hear what kind of advice do you have for, you know, young up-and-coming engineers? I know there's a lot of people that are, you know, interested in kind of doing what you do, and loved hearing your history. But what kind of advice do you have for them, you know, up-and-coming roller coaster designers or park designers that would help them on their path?
You know, anymore, you get bombarded with resumes and occasional phone calls, but also at the trade show, which is fine and great because ultimately it's the way I did it as well, but is to figure out how to set yourself apart from that. And one of the things that I had been telling folks for a long time, when you send a resume, you know, to us, make it memorable. For a lot of reasons, resumes all, if you literally lay 10 of them out, they all look exactly the same. Mm-hmm. I hate to say that, but they do. But do something to your resume. Make it interesting, you know. It would certainly get attention here, I will tell you that. The other thing is, if you had like a business card, I always said it's really interesting if you could put your face on a business card, because people typically, even if they don't remember your name, they remember a face. You know, it's like you could say, hey, we've talked before, and they'd be like, yeah, I've seen your face before. I remember you, but I don't quite get it. But I think a lot of times that's also a good thing. So facial recognition can go a long way, because typically if I have a business card laying on my desk from a vendor, you know, if they don't have a really amazing logo or something on their business card, if they're a face on there, you certainly remember who they are.
Right.
For instance, a lot of the transportation companies that like freight companies that give you trucks and, you know, move stuff around the United States for you, they almost always have their face on their card. And you know who else does is a realtor.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think, you know, that's a good way to market yourself. And in this industry, that's what you're doing in the beginning. You're trying to set yourself apart from, you know, 2,000 other people that want the same thing. And you're going to have to do that with a visual appeal right off the bat, because otherwise, you know, you might just kind of get blown through as another resume that comes across the desk.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could set yourself apart in those beginning, you know, contacts with someone, I think that's probably a big notch forward. So the other thing is to be persistent but not annoying. You know, it's one thing to be persistent and be like, oh, wow, this guy's he's called back all the time and he's really interested and excited about, you know, working in the industry. But sometimes it can get a little pushy. At the trade show, it sometimes gets a little pushy. And
mm-hmm.
ultimately, you know, we're there trying to conduct business and sell roller coasters, and we have 4 days to do it. And it gets a little busy, and sometimes it's tough to talk to everybody that comes there to, you know, that wants a job. My suggestion for that at IAPA would be is try to set up some sort of time frame during the IAPA show to have like a 10 or 15 minute meeting as a face-to-face meeting with one of the engineers or with one of the companies that you want to work for. I would also say try to make it for Friday, especially with the big roller coaster manufacturers, because Friday tends to be the slowest day of the whole show.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times I've actually told people at the show, why don't you come back on Friday, because we're probably going to be a little slower and we'll have some more time to give you. But, yeah, I would definitely try to set those things up if you can. If anything, if no one ever responds to you, at least you send them a letter and saying, hey, I'd like to come speak to you at the show on Friday. So that would be the biggest thing of advice to give to anybody going to the IAPA show. The other thing is don't be afraid to call someone up and say, hey, can I come get a tour? You know, that happens here quite a bit because we're in Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also another great way to kind of get your face in front of somebody and say, hey, this is who I am and this is what I want to do and I'm really interested in your company. You know, do you have any intern positions? Are you looking to hire anybody soon? You know, if so, please keep me in mind. But at least your face is there and it looks like you've done some legwork in order to try to get it.
Right, and you've put in the effort on your end, not just expecting something, just, hey, here's my resume, I'm great, you know, hire me because of that. You have to put in the work on your end, too, as an applicant.
Right. I honestly think if I went back and looked at all the money that I spent when I was in the military trying to network at the IAPA show for, you know, the 5 years that I was doing it, and then going to visit coaster manufacturers and setting up meetings and also amusement park folks, I probably spent $10,000 to $15,000 of my money trying to break into this thing. So, you know, it's one of those things where it's a long, concerted effort for a lot of people, and you just got to continually be persistent and put your face out there and, you know, try to figure out how to make people remember you.
Absolutely.
You know, when you're looking for new applicants, are you generally looking for people that are fresh out of college with a mechanical engineering degree, or are you also looking for people who have experience, you know, with some manufacturing or engineering or design or even within the industry or whatnot, or is it just all in one?
I think that depends on what we're looking for. You know, right now we have three people that's been at Great Coasters for quite a while, so they all have quite a bit of experience. And then we have three other folks that had just graduated with their mechanical engineering degree. And one of them, actually two of them, had interned for us at the trade show. And then Colin had worked for us at Great Coasters as an intern for over a year. And then when we moved down here, he'd been working part-time for us for quite a while, and he just finished school up last year, actually just back in May. And he started full-time in May. But, yeah, I think, you know, if you're looking for experience, it's one thing. But if you just need an engineer to, you know, kind of help you get things moving and going, then it's a different thing. So we're always looking for a little bit of both.
Yeah, and I would think that it's the marriage, you know, of those kind of the technical skills and even passion for the industry that would make the best kind of applicant, especially for this kind of thing where it's, you know, if you don't have a passion for creating a great guest experience, it's going to be hard to translate that into a great ride, I would think.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is we try to find people that are like us, you know, that love roller coasters, that know roller coasters, that have worked on them at some point in time, that have probably worked in an amusement park at some point in time. I mean, I ran the Cannonball down in, Waterville, USA in Alabama for years. For a whole summer, I was there part-time in the military, and then I would drive over to Gulf Shores and basically run the ride on Friday night, all day Saturday, and all day Sunday, and then go back and be in the military through the week. And so it was all about trying to, you know, gain that experience of how these places work operationally, but also how these rides work mechanically, you know, and being fascinated enough about it to try to, you know, do whatever it took to get some sort of experience, you know, in the industry. And I think ultimately you look back on some of that experience for that summer, it's priceless. The stuff that I learned about the operations of a ride and the operations of a park and how a ride, you know, operates mechanically, that goes a long way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I have a question that kind of goes along with that, but kind of goes back to when Roller Coaster Tycoon was really big. And everybody saw themselves as a coaster designer because they could do it in Roller Coaster Tycoon. But what do real roller coaster designers know and live by that, you know, amateurs don't know? You know, what are the things that you think about and really concentrate on more than just, you know, clicking on a S turn and putting it in Roller Coaster Tycoon? What are some of those things?
For me, it's funny because I tell Jeff this story all the time, or we used to talk about it, not so much all the time, but I always said a roller coaster should be like a book, and it should start telling you that story from the time you lay eyes on it. So as you walk up to it, you know, what it's doing in three-dimensional space and how it looks and how it's engulfing your field of vision. And so that's basically the first chapters of the book. And then you walk up to it, and then you get into the sounds and the smells and try to think about how it invokes emotion using all senses. And then, of course, the ride itself of how it's moving and twisting in space, going around certain things and over water if that's there, or you know, in tunnels and trees. But you're trying to figure out how this thing is going to tell its story from the very beginning to the time that your back is turned to it and you're walking away and you're still hearing it behind you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, something that is always invoking the senses as you, from the beginning to the end. But ultimately when, you know, you're laying out a center line, I think that's one of the coolest things to think about and actually try to work around. You know, and then you get some exciting stuff with topography, and, you know, you can really get some crazy stuff going on with that. So I always thought it was fun to lay out a ride on a hillside, but it also makes it very challenging at the same time. But, yeah, those are the things that I'm thinking about. How does this look? How would it feel, you know, as you're going over a big drop? Is that going to look cool? Is that going to be cool? Is that going to, you know, give the intent of scaring the hell out of somebody, or just, you know, being Grand Mal's pleasure ride? So, you know, it's all those things kind of combined. You know, and it starts out with the lay of the land, and a lot of times you'll print out these, it's a basic drawing of where somebody says the ride can be inside this piece.
Mm-hmm.
And printing that out on several pieces of paper and then just saying, okay, if I put the station here and I put the maintenance building here, I'm going to have good access for the maintenance guys in this maintenance building and the lift here. You know, I want to try to use some of the topography, so I want the lift to kind of go in this direction. Occasionally a park will come to you and say, you know, this is where we need to put this building. No questions. This is where it's got to be. And, of course, that'll dictate a lot of those other things, but I think if you have a good design theory in your head, you can still work with that quite a bit and come up with something that's very creative and unique.
And I think your story analogy is really interesting, because I also think of, when I'm on a coaster, I think about the pacing, you know, which would be, you know, the beginning, middle, and end of the kind of the story part when you're on the coaster. So how do you pace the coaster so it's not too intense, but still, like you said, is thrilling, can scare the crap out of people. But when it needs to kind of slow down and, you know, let people catch their breath, how do you kind of work that into your design?
I think when you're doing a layout, it just kind of naturally happens. You know, for instance, I was doing some of the very preliminary centerline work on the big Viper ride in China that Great Coasters built. We did that well before I had left. You know, and Jeff comes in and puts the real numbers, and he's the real designer behind it. But occasionally some of us would be lucky enough to play with those center lines in the beginning. And basically we would always call it the teaser horse. So basically you were the guy that would tease the client with this really spectacular looking center line that didn't have a whole lot of numbers behind it, but enough to say that it could work.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I probably did four or five renditions of the first run out on that thing, trying to figure out how the hell to make that S-turn drop happen, because I had been fascinated with those since the Rattler when I was a kid, and I rode the Rattler the year it opened. And so, you know, Renegade was also one of those rides where it was like, let's do an S-turn drop, because I always thought they were wicked cool. And trying to make that S-turn drop work with a certain point of the ride, they wanted it to go a certain speed. And then to give somebody a little bit of a breather after that, because it was going to be an intense 7 or 8 seconds. And that's where the whole initiative of jumping up into that big high turn and turning around before we come back down and laid back inside the the structure to parallel it to come back. And so, you know, I think it's just one of those things that just naturally happens a lot of times.
Hmm, cool.
Chris, do you still build models?
Yeah. I actually, the last model I built was, I did two last year for IAPA. One was for Mach, their little coaster that was launching back and forth, and then our Skywarp model that we took to the show.
Because you got me thinking about that when you were talking about the story and really kind of putting a good visual into my head. And so I'm curious, you know, how you get that visual to then build that model, and also just the patience you have for that much detail you put into it. It's very impressive.
Well, thanks. You know, when it comes to building, like the Cobra's Curse model, for instance, everything was designed. I literally had to take all their drawings and make it look exactly like they had, but much smaller. So a lot of times when you're building those kind of models, the creative side of that, I always said, comes about by material manipulations. What kind of materials can you manipulate to look like miniature rock? Or how are you going to paint this wall to make it look like it's a painted wall or sculpted wall on the model? And, you know, you're talking about things that are just teeny, teeny, tiny. And ultimately on those kinds of models, that freedom, that's the edge of that freedom, you know, because you're literally trying to make it look exactly like their pictures. And then when you're doing the track itself, the track, you're just always trying to keep it as true to, you know, what the designer was trying to convey as much as possible. So it's not very often that I have time anymore to do something that's loosey-goosey and fancy and free. But if you go back and look at some of the smaller things that I was doing when I was in the military, it would all start with these little drawings of basic shapes and then something moving around those shapes, so where I wanted the coaster's path to go. And then ultimately I'd do like a little three-dimensional drawing, just a hand sketch, and then ultimately that would transpire to something small on a palette that you'd build up the topography and then build up the buildings and then try to figure out how this, you know, ride was going to fit through them per the drawing that you had created. And so you're basically taking these two-dimensional images and trying to manipulate them in three-dimensional space. And, you know, nowadays it's all done on the computer, so a lot of these guys can whip this stuff out in minutes in comparison to what we were doing 20 years ago, where we were trying to convey, you know, an idea off of a 2D drawing into a three-dimensional object. It could take months. And, you know, and that's just based on technology moving faster than we can blink. But I still say, you know, there's a lot to one of those three-dimensional models. When somebody typically sees one, it invokes them enough typically to go over and look and continue to look for quite a while. So, you know, that's one of the reasons everybody wants to take a model to a trade show typically, is because it pulls a lot of traffic over to the booth. Makes the booth look really big,
sure,
whether they're buying a roller coaster or not.
Right. Right.
Right.
So,
do you find that the models help with the engineering of the actual ride, or is it the other way around? Is it fully engineered,
you know,
and the model is the conceptual?
I would have never said that until we built the Skywarp model. Because they can move this model around whenever they want and position the train in different places and look at the geometry and how things are going with the wheel bogies to the track and where the supports are, that it has honestly to God been instrumental in trying to figure out how this thing, this Skywarp ride, is going to function and do maintenance on and the whole thing. So, yeah, it's, you know, and again, that's something that I never would have said until that happens. But the model sets about 50 feet out in front of my desk, and I literally see these guys and gals come up and start pushing that train around and pointing and putting Post-it notes on it. And so I'm like, wow, this is pretty crazy. And then, you know, it's been said many times, this model has been instrumental in helping us figure out how to do certain mechanical aspects of this ride. So, you know, it's really bizarre. I think if you maybe have some new, you know, crazy concept, the model probably could help you try to figure out how to make certain aspects of it work. And it, you know, depends on what you have built the model to do. I think if it was a static model, it would have been a lot more difficult. But since this thing actually functions and works, you can really, you know, move it around and see what's going on. So I think a lot of it has to do, too, because it's so different. It's such a big, you know, system that's got to work, and there's a lot of chassis, and there's a lot of wheels, and there's a lot of things to figure out that's never been done before. You know, I think if it was a simple train with a lift hill and 2,000 feet of track, it wouldn't be something that a model could possibly help on.
Yeah, then it would just be, you know, fun to look at, but not necessarily, like you say, helpful and advantageous.
Yeah. I think that's something that, you know, as we develop new concepts and new ideas here, if it's something that we think, you know, a big functional model would actually help us on, I'm pretty sure that we'd probably go for it, because ultimately the guys know that we have two model guys here on staff now. We have Adam Yurden from, he now works for us, and he was from Great Coasters, but he's a terrific modeler. And so the two of us, if, you know, together, there's a lot of potential there to build some really cool stuff.
Really interesting. I wish I could be a fly on the wall in those meetings.
Yeah, well, I don't know. You would probably starve, because those meetings are really long.
You know, another thing that I'm kind of wondering about, and just kind of seeing the evolution of rides. You know, we talked a little bit about the Rocky Mountain refab earlier. What are your thoughts on virtual reality and kind of retrofitting an existing ride with just a whole new storyline and theme with the VR concept? What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I've only done the one here in town when Funspot did it with Mac a year and a half ago at the IAPA show. I haven't been on the SeaWorld Kraken yet. I heard it's pretty cool. It's just a matter of trying to get everybody on the ride. And
right.
It sounds like it's pretty tough to get throughput. It'll be interesting to see where it goes. It doesn't feel as rock solid as, you know, a ride. It feels almost like a fad. But again, you know what? I could be completely wrong, and this could be the way everything is moving. I just don't know that the technology for that is completely there yet to make it easy and attainable for a big park to be able to pull the numbers that they want to pull on rides with VR. I think there's probably a way to do it. No one's maybe just come up with it yet. But it's definitely a really interesting, cool concept. So I think you're going to see a lot more stuff come out of this, of course, in the next few years. I always thought it was interesting when they started the whole Ham on Rye back in the day, you know, and they had these big audiences of people wearing these headsets. And, you know, that kind of went somewhere for about a year and a half, and then it went away. And it'll be interesting to see where this one goes. I think there's a little more staying power with what's going on right now, just because everybody's fascinated with headsets and VR sets. But we'll certainly see where this takes us down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, you know, I got to do Fun Spots as well last year, and I thought it was phenomenal. I thought it was done so well, and I did it at an after hours event, so I didn't have to stand in line and kind of go through the whole process of it. My biggest concern, as far as just the whole industry goes, is just the efficiency of it, and being able to dispatch trains in the same interval as they normally are. And I think that's something that, you know, our industry as a whole needs to get their VR is really going to catch on. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. You know, and the other thing for me is I always thought it would be interesting that if I was at a park that had one of these on a newer ride that I'd never rode, I would probably opt not to do it the first time.
Right.
You know, and just say, no, I want to ride the ride for what it's worth. I don't necessarily need to put this thing on my head. If there was time maybe in the day to come back and try it with the VR, but I don't know for me personally if it would be something that I would run back over and do right away. So it's definitely an interesting concept, though, and I think there's lots of things to figure out, and it's certainly doing what it needs to be doing for these parks, or they wouldn't continue to be doing it, so something's working.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, Chris, I know we've talked about a lot of things, and some of the things have, you know, kind of led to where we, kind of things are going in the industry, but kind of just as a last wrap-up question, would love to hear your thoughts on, you know, where you think rides or attractions or just the experience is going, and, you know, if you could look ahead 20 years, which I know is a long time, especially with how quickly things move, but just kind of where do you think things are going, and
and what direction you think we're headed?
Yeah, I think honestly the word is interactivity. What else can you do to make the person actually on the ride physically react to the things that are going on around him or her? Ultimately, you know, the VR headsets play a lot into that, where things can change and be different almost every single time that you're actually on an attraction. I really think is, and we've thought about it a lot, is how do we make the experience as interactive as possible for the person riding or, you know, experiencing the attraction? And I think you're going to see more and more of that. You know, that was the whole concept of the Games You Ride thing, and how do you make someone else participate? And we have some other ideas about how to make those even better. So you'd have participation on both sides of the game aspect. So I think once somebody figures out how to do that, that's the next step. The other thing is everybody's so attached to their phone, is trying to figure out ways to, you know, make something happen with their phone, either while they're waiting in line or actually while they're riding. You know, I think you're going to see a lot more of that coming around as well.
Definitely see a lot of that. And, you know, you see people, you know, kind of getting in that, going in that direction and maybe not going as immersive or as interactive as maybe they could be, but, you know, it's an experiment, and sometimes you have to take baby steps on those things.
Yeah, you know, you're right. I think so, too. You know, I hope we never see the day where nobody wants to ride a roller coaster, but ultimately when everybody's flying off to space on SpaceX, it might not be as exciting to ride a roller coaster.
Right. I don't know that we'll see that in our lifetime. Well, maybe we will. Who knows?
You never know. Funny enough, you know, we're here in Orlando. We actually do some fun things with the guys and gals a lot of times if we can. And on Monday, for instance, anytime there's a rocket launch, everybody here is all excited.
Oh, yeah.
And so on Monday, there was a SpaceX rocket launch, and I live on this small lake here in Orlando that allows us a nice vista to be able to see rockets go up out on the Cape. And we all went there for lunch, and I made hot dogs for everybody for lunch, and ultimately we sat there and watched, you know, SpaceX launch and then come back down, and we actually heard the sonic boom on the way back down. You know, it's one of those things where we're always trying to think of new ways to keep everybody kind of hip and excited and, you know, of doing things in the office and taking people out, and we go, you know, on trips to Busch Gardens and do safaris. But that was one of our little outings the other day where we decided, you know, let's go see this rocket launch, and that was actually a lot of fun. But, you know, we're all fascinated with that industry, so as soon as it's affordable to, you know, fly up into the stratosphere, I'm all for that. So, but ultimately, I'm terrified that that's going to make everybody think that roller coasters are lame and no one's going to want to ride them anymore.
Yeah, I as a roller coaster fan, I hope that's not the case as well.
Yeah.
But I think there's enough of them around still that I think will be around at least for my lifetime that I'll still be able to ride them enough.
Yeah, I think you're right as well. But ultimately, you know, that's us. We love roller coasters. We love building them. We love designing them. We like riding them. Hell, we go all over the world riding them. So, you know, in the short term, let's just keep making roller coasters as cool and fun as possible.
Absolutely. Well, I can't think of a better way to end the podcast. Of course, we could talk about this stuff for hours and hours and hours. But it's also National Roller Coaster Day, so we're looking forward to all the announcements that are coming out. So, Chris, thank you so much for your time. If somebody wants to learn a little bit more about you or Skyline Attractions, how can they find out more or get in touch with you?
You can go to skylineattractions.com, and you can read our little bios online, but also you can contact us at info@skylineattractions.com.
Awesome. Well, Chris, again, thank you so much for your time, and I look forward to seeing you at IAAPA.
Yeah, thanks, guys. I really appreciate it, and we'll see you in a couple months.
Very good.
Sounds good. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Attraction Pros Podcast. For more information on Josh Liebman, please visit AmusementAdvantage.com. For more information on Matt Heller, please visit PerformanceOptimist.com.